You want to make sure this isn't maybe their first one they've managed. Everybody's got to be the first one, but you really want somebody that's got a track record, has been doing this for a while, maybe has a couple thousand units under management, so you're comfortable, because there is always something new to learn.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon, and I am super pumped to have Matt Hansen on the pod today. Matt is a retired corporate executive that has now transitioned full-time into real estate and being a real estate investor full-time. He's got about 2,000 multifamily units in his portfolio currently, and he actually just got started a handful of years ago in real estate. Up until that point, he had been doing what most people do, and that's investing in the stock market and 401k before jumping into real estate investing. So really interesting. We dive into some of the trials and tribulations that go into real estate investing, both actively and passively, and how important the asset manager is to a real estate deal being successful or not successful. So we dig into some really cool stuff here. So I'm really excited to have Matt on, and let's welcome him to the show. Awesome, man. Matt, thanks for being on the pod. Really excited to chat with you.
My pleasure to be here.
So let's jump right in here. Maybe just give a quick overview of who you are, how you got into real estate, and then we'll go through some stuff.
Sure. I'm a retired corporate executive. So I was one of those schmucks that had 100% of their money in the stock market until about 7 years ago.
Okay.
They discovered this large multifamily investing thing. That's how I got. And then since I've retired, and now I work on syndicating deals, raise capital, do marketing, and partner with other individuals to help them escape the volatility of the stock market.
Yeah. So what did you do in your corporate world? Let's chat about that real quick, and then we'll jump into the real estate stuff.
I was a global supply chain director for a large Fortune 100 chemical company. So my job, I had people all around the world. We moved hazardous chemicals in planes, trains, automobiles, rail cars, and all ships. So that was my job. I managed a $1 billion business group. So I had a profit and loss budgets that I had to manage, and I had people around the world I managed. So this multifamily thing was just like running a business. It's really the same thing. It's all business.
Yeah.
So it was a really easy transition from that perspective in terms of economic analysis. Every day I'd make $1 million decisions, whether we do this or do that, do this. And it really translated well into multifamily, particularly the large multifamily stuff.
And when you were in your career, like what was your investing thesis? What was your investing education? And then talk about that up until you started to learn about multifamily. So I'm curious what people were taught as they were in a corporate world making money. And what do you do with it?
Yeah. So I started back in like 1989. It's my first corporate gig there. And it was the stock market. I read the Wall Street Journal every day. I had 100% of my portfolio was in the stock market until about 7 years ago. And then 2008-09, you had a little thing going on there.
Yeah.
That really wised up. It took a big, huge hit on that. So yeah, I did what everybody told me to do. I had a ton of money in my 401k.
Yep.
And since I retired, I was able to roll it over into a self-directed IRA. And now I'm invested in all sorts of things, not only real estate, a lot of venture capital, startup businesses, all sorts of things that escapes the manipulation and volatility of the stock market. So yeah, I was taught to, I did what I was told 30 years ago and had a ton of money in a 401k.
Yeah, and the American dream, work for a company for as long as you can, hope there's enough money in your retirement account to live a quality life for the last how many years of your life. So yeah, no, that's totally fair. And then I had a guest on a few podcasts ago, Josh Plaith, very detailed, you know, Josh, in the self-directed IRA space. You mentioned venture capital. Are you invested in venture capital deals with your self-directed IRA?
With inside and outside of it, yes, you can do that.
Okay. Very interesting. My wife and I's first two real estate deals were with self-directed IRAs. So the things you don't know with money that is just sitting there from previous jobs, and it's theoretically growing and moving and ebbing and flowing with the market, but you can actually take that money and work with it. And obviously, if you can't use the cash, you have to just keep all the money in the account because it's a retirement account. But no, super interesting. So I guess what was the tipping point for you 7 years ago when you had 100% of your money in the stock market, in your 401k, and then how did you hear about real estate investing?
Yeah, I started to, my kids went off to college and everything. My wife and I were empty nesters a while back. And so I started to get back into single family home. We would buy a house, hold it for a year. So we have long-term capital gains and I do all the work myself. So I started doing that again. And I started listening to podcasts and I discovered this whole thing about syndications and hold it. None of this work and it's just running a business. I just stumbled across it because I was getting back into real estate again as an investor. Because we used to invest before it was a thing 30 years ago. My wife and I used to flip houses 30 some years ago. We made it really well at that. Then we started having kids and that wasn't practical. So that's how I stumbled across it. It was like, I heard it on a podcast and that was like 7 years ago. And then I really got involved in it because it's just business.
Yeah.
Economic analysis.
So how did you make the transition mentally? Because obviously a lot of people start out if they're active or even some passive in, I think I'm going to go small. I'm going to do a single family or flip. My wife and I started out in 2 to 4 units because I thought single family was risky because it's one unit, one tenant. And if they leave, you're on the hook for the whole mortgage. How did you take that and then confident to go into syndications? Because obviously it's way different. It is like a business, right? So it's not just saying, okay, the mortgage is $1,000 and I'm making $1,300 on rent. So I'm going to make a little bit of money on that deal. How do you make that transition and talk about your first deal?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, I had a lot of funds available to invest passively. So I passively invest in probably 4 or 5 deals before I started running my own deals.
Okay.
And my first deal was a 252 unit in Memphis. An $8 million deal. So that was my first deal. Again, with some partners that were already doing deals and leveraged. You always have to leverage somebody else's expertise when you're first starting out because you have zero credibility. So that's my first deal that turned out really well. We refinanced it a couple of years ago, pulled out a whole bunch of the money, and it's been fabulous. And I've done a lot of passive investing as well. I've learned more from some of those passive investings than the ones I've done myself. Those are the ones I've had challenges with. Versus my own. But fortunately, I got to be a limited partner before I became a general partner. So I really understood the feelings, the emotions, the expectations of a limited partner, which makes you a really good general partner. You've been in their shoes.
Yeah, I think that is super important because that's exactly how I've done it. We got our first deal as a limited partner because I wanted to, knowing that I was going to hopefully be successful and have deals of my own, whether I'm partnering with other people and raising money or I find the deal myself or whatever, you want to be able to go through and tell your investors, like, here's what to expect, here's what happened to me, and talk through that stuff. So before we jump into that shift from passive to active, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. So we will be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back with the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. We've got Matt Hansen on. So before the break, Matt was talking about how he started out passive investing, wanting to learn the process before taking some of his funds and also becoming a general partner. So I guess talk about, first of all, how did you find the deals to be a passive investor? Because they're not just laying around on the ground. How did you find those deals and those partners? And then also talk about how you felt comfortable trusting people because you're not giving them $5, you're giving them thousands of dollars. So talk through that process a little bit.
Well, I went to Dallas. I live in Michigan, went to Dallas and joined one of those high-priced masterminds like 7 years ago.
Okay.
So that's where I started the network of individuals, getting to know them, know who the good operators. It's a real small community, as you know, Justin. People talk. So you find out who do you want to invest with and who you maybe shouldn't invest with. So I had that insider knowledge. So I was comfortable when I did place my money for the passive limited partner investing. But even one of those went sideways on me.
Yeah,
something had happened that wasn't really super predictable. So I guess that was the way to get into passive investing because you really need to check their credentials, check their background.
Yeah.
Really important what their track record looks like because you're trusting them with your money for up to 6 years.
Yeah. And you also want to make sure that they have some skin in the game too, right? You want to make sure that they're not just a deal hunter and then they raise all the equity. You want to make sure they're investing their own capital in the deals as well. And so a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are where you were 8, 9, 10 years ago. They're working hard. They make good money. They've historically just put all their money into the stock market, their 401k, right, et cetera. But they're now, obviously, they listen to this podcast, so they're starting to get curious about other alternative investments, if you will, and real estate being one of them. So I guess walk through that process of how would you start to vet, or what would you recommend somebody to do as they're starting to talk to people if they go to a conference and they're like, hey, I met Matt, and what questions would you expect them to ask you if you have a deal that you're looking to raise money on?
A really good question. So I would just start the basic things like, what is my investment strategy? Because every syndicator or general partner has different strategies. Do you want to invest in class A? Do you want to invest in class B or C value adds or whatever? Yep. So you want to have exposure to all those or understand what those are. And then based on your risk tolerance, your personal risk tolerance, say, you know what? I'm not really concerned about a big cash out at the end with a value add. I just want steady cash flow. Well, then probably invest in a class A that's going to be kicking out distributions on a quarterly base. Yeah. So I guess know thyself first, figure out what you want to do from your investments, and then find somebody that's matching that they're doing things that you're comfortable with, the risk level, the location that it's at, the returns, and most importantly, investigate the operator. Who's the asset manager? Who's going to run and manage your money for the next 6 years? That's the most important individual. And I think early on, I missed that a little bit. One of my first one or two, I knew some of the partners, but I didn't know the person running the deal.
Yep.
And that was the one mistake I think I made in one of the deals. They had a capital call because some of the individuals weren't real strong players. And I didn't vet all the general partners. I just vetted the guy I knew, like, and trust. I didn't vet them all. So that would be my lesson. Vet all the GPs, know who's the asset manager and who is backing them up.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You mentioned a couple things there, but we're recording this in early April 2023. Interest rates are high, there's inflation scares, all that fun stuff. And if you bought a deal a few years ago or back in 2019, 2018, you could have run it into the ground and it still would have made a bunch of money because the market just appreciated so much over the last few years. So you didn't have to be a good operator to really make returns for your investors. So everybody looked like a rock star. And obviously now we're in a situation where people actually really have to work and operate the property. And all the deals that we look at are 100 to 300 units on average, right? And so there's on-site property managers that are running the day-to-day physical property, managing leases and maintenance orders and all that stuff. But you mentioned an asset manager. So maybe talk about what an asset manager does or maybe is supposed to do and how that person can help protect your investment as a passive investor.
Good. Excellent. So the asset manager is one of the general partners. Well, they typically are a general partner, or you could hire a third-party individual. But their job is to really manage, think of them as a general manager of the apartment complex.
Yep.
They're going to be accountable or responsible for all the metrics. They're working with the property management company. At least once a week, they're talking to them, looking at the key performance indicators. What's the occupancy? What's the delinquency? What's the turnover rate? Are we renovating units? So that's the person that's going to be managing that investment for you. And they're the representing the general partners and the limited partners to the property management company and all that. So they're responsible for making sure the tax forms get done and all those things. So it's a really critical role. So you want to vet that person well. You want to make sure this isn't maybe their first one they've managed.
Right.
Everybody's got to be the first one, but you really want somebody that's got a track record, has been doing this for a while, maybe has a couple thousand units under management that have been doing it. So you're comfortable because there is always something new to learn. There's always different events that occur in the world, in the economy, and locally. If you've got somebody that's seen a lot of those, when those things happen, they just roll with the punches and they deal with it versus wigging out. What do I do with the scenario? COVID hit. What do we do? If you have a seasoned asset manager, they fared much better than the ones that weren't.
Yeah. And I think you hit a lot of things that it's important because they're the ones that are not day to day because they're not on site, but they're the ones that are thinking about Well, one, if you get into a value add, they're the ones that are managing and overseeing the property managers and the construction teams and getting bids. And they're the ones that are actually getting all that information so that they can execute on the business plan, right? And then also, if the property manager isn't doing or isn't achieving what they thought they could do, because typically you're working with a property manager as you're analyzing a deal, right? You're going to partner with them to make sure that the rents that you are projecting are feasible and all that fun stuff. So, and then also that communication back to the investor. I think that's like one of the most important things is making sure that you're consistent with your communication. And you can set expectations, whether it's a monthly communication or a quarterly communication, just what's going on at the property. Good and bad, right? Because if I'm a limited partner, I want to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. I don't want to be, I'd rather know bad news than no news, right? So yeah, the asset manager, especially this year, I've been on a bunch of podcasts. And I think I've said it on every one. This is like the year of the operator. Like the deals that are going to be successful, the deals that are going to weather the storm, and you got to have a good operator. And the operator in this case is the asset manager for sure. So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now. You started out passive investing, got to know some good operators. You joined a group, and let's actually touch on that a little bit. This is like running a business and me transitioning into real estate from my recruiting world. It's like going back to school. It's a whole new underwriting 150, 200 unit apartment complex is not the easiest thing to do. It's working with a lot of partners. So how did you get to that educational point and talk a little bit about some of the mentorship programs or courses or gurus that you worked with just to get yourself comfortable?
Yeah. So I did start off with the one that I didn't stay for very long, but I did get a good basis. They had a good modules and learning, the terminology. So you're really comfortable with it. So that really was my basis. And it was a very high price mastermind, but it wasn't right for me. It wasn't a good fit for me. So I did passive investing in that group. And then a few years later, I switched to another group. And that one, I started running deals. It was a smaller, more cohesive. Again, if you're going to join a mastermind, I thought I vetted the first one. I did vet it pretty well, but it just wasn't what I thought. So then once you get into the business, you realize, okay, which one's a good fit for me? Which one isn't? Right. And I transitioned to another one. And that's where I found most of my business partners within that group. They've already been pre-vetted. They're all performing at a certain level. There are standards set. So you know, if you're going to partner with this person, this is the expectations. This is how they're going to run their asset. So there's some advantages to getting educated. So you know, as a baseline, what you want, and then you find your business partners. That's the hardest thing, is finding a good business partner.
Yeah.
It dives with you and it has the same values you do, the same business acumen that you do. And that's really key.
And they also probably have strengths that are maybe your weaknesses and you've got weaknesses that are their strengths and vice versa and all that stuff. So it is almost like dating, right? You've got to kiss a lot of frogs, so to speak, and make sure you can know, like, and trust that person enough to, I guess, let's talk about your first one. Did you find that deal or did somebody else found it? And then you came in and helped from investor relations, raising money perspective.
Yeah, the first deal, I've ran about five deals or so. Somebody else found the deal and they had a team, they were assembling a team and they need somebody that had really strong business experience and run profit and loss for $1 billion business unit. So yeah, I was pretty qualified for that. I managed people. Right. It's like herding cats when you're trying to close a large apartment deal.
Yep.
You're dealing with your lender, the broker, the insurance company, the legal team, all the financing and all that. So that was my job, is to corral all the cats, make sure everything was being done. Everybody knew what their roles and responsibilities were. And I did that for quite a few deals, but that was my expertise, was the coming in and running the deal, just because I knew how to run a large business. And I'd run $1 million projects at work too. It's the same thing. Right. Buying an apartment is just a project. You just need to sign all the responsibilities, make sure everybody's accountable and meet your timelines.
Yeah, it's all a matter of setting expectations and knowing who's supposed to do what, and then making sure you're accountable and you actually follow through on all that fun stuff. So, no, that makes sense. And I guess, what are you doing now? Again, April 2023 is when we're recording this. So, are you looking at deals? Are you analyzing deals? Like, what's your focus right now?
My primary focus is partnering with other individuals that are finding the deals, and then I'll join the team and help with the marketing, the capital raising, and I can do due diligence. I've done everything end to end myself.
Yeah.
So kind of whatever they need for me to fill in on, but I'm not doing the major leading role like I used to do. That's just a lot of work. I'm retired. I don't want to work that hard.
No,
but
I
it is
that.
Fun. So yeah, I'm fortunate that I've got enough people. I've partnered with people in Florida, people in Texas, people in Arizona. So the markets I bring our investors into, I've got boots on the ground, somebody that I know, like, and trust for 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Yep.
So it's really, I'm in a good position just because of 7 years of experience. I know who do I want to work with, who do I don't want to work with, and who is aligned with my goals.
Yeah.
So it's really a blast. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. The real estate game is fun. You learn something new. You get to work with a lot of different people and travel to some cool places, some places that maybe you wouldn't think would be fun, but you can invest there and they have really good cash flowing assets and all that fun stuff. So as you think about who you're partnering with maybe this year, are they active? Or obviously, if you're not the one actively searching for deals, are they still looking for deals in this high interest rate environment?
Yes, I've got one of my friends that he finds a deal, I'm going to be partnering with him. And they're actively looking. That underwriting is really critical. So he's a superstar at underwriting things.
Yeah.
He's got a really strong finance background. And that's what you want to look for. Somebody that he does this for a living. That he's in finance. So this is a perfect fit. So I'm really confident when he brings me a deal, it's going to be a winner. So I'm working with, and I've got a couple people in different locations that they know if they have a really solid deal that I would like to partner with them. It's just putting yourself out there saying, okay, here's the roles I would like to fill. And here's my criteria. If you have something that matches that, maybe we can work together.
How are deals looking compared to a year or two ago when everything was 10 plus cash on cash return, 20 IRR, all that fun stuff? Like, what are the deals that they're looking at? Are they having to adjust their performance metrics to accommodate the high interest rate environment that we're in, especially because the interest rates were 3-4 a year ago, and now they're 7-something, right? So what are they telling you as far as deals go?
Yeah, there's an adjustment. And I think the biggest adjustment is going to be with passive investors. They've been accustomed to 10% cash on cash and 20 IRR. Well, you know what? I saw one across my desk of somebody, an offering, 5% cash on cash return.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. I don't think we're going to go that low, but the deals that we're criteria is still about 8% cash on cash as we're targeting. So we've lowered it a little bit, but still we're not going to do a deal if it's 5%. I just don't think that's great. There's not much room for error there. If you're saying this is your expectation, what if things get really bad and now you're down to 2% or 1? So
we're T-bills for 4.5% right now.
Like, really? I'm going to invest in real estate at 5%? But
they're
out there. People are doing deals. And again, no offense to them. That's fine. That's their business strategy. But no, we're not going to do a deal if that's the only returns. I think that's not real great for investors.
I think because I look at deals every once in a while. I live in Austin, so I would love to find a deal locally, but it's very competitive and all that fun stuff. But I like San Antonio a lot. I think that's a good market. It's more stable. It's like an older market in the sense that there's a lot of just stability there. There's a lot of good industry there. And I was talking to a buddy of mine. I was like, if you can find a deal that works now, it should be a pretty attractive deal because odds are a year, 2 years from now, interest rates won't be at 7 or 8. I would like to believe, and I'm not an economist or anything like that, so don't take this as advice, but in the 5s and 6s, right? So if you're refinancing, you're actually lowering your interest rate. Well, that's interesting when you roll into fixed rate debt. So I'm seeing distress out there right now. I've had a few actually property managers that I've talked to in San Antonio have called me and said, hey, our owner of a deal is going to have to sell. Are you interested in looking at it? And I was like, sure. Like, I'll look at something that they're just undercapitalized. They came in, they may have competed with me on the deal and I lost and they won. And now they're like, oh crap, I overpaid and don't have enough money in the bank to operate the deal. Right. So I think there's still, I was talking to another person in the acquisitions the other day, and she's saying, I think the pain is going to continue to grow and potentially Q3 of this year, depending on what rates do, it may hit a point where people will start to have to exit or recapitalize their deal, right? I've heard a few deals that I'm not invested in, but that are thinking about recapitalizing, which means essentially the general partners get bought out and a new general partnership team comes in with more money that thinks they can operate the deal better, which is good for the LPs because they're sitting on maybe a loser and now they're going to be saved. So yeah, it's very interesting times. I've only been doing this for 4 years now. So it was COVID when I started and now it's high interest rates. I've seen a lot of different market cycles in the last few years. But let's transition a little bit here. And I'm curious, we talked about education, which I think is a very important part if you are starting your investing journey, whether it's passive or active. And I think it's still important to know a little bit as a passive investor, right? You need to know the jargon. I think to your point, know thyself, know what you want and what your risk profile is. But if somebody's listening to this and they're like, okay, what should I do? How should I get involved? Like, how do you get started, right? Obviously, they're listening to this podcast, so they're interested in getting education and hearing some folks talk about it. But what do you think is a good first step?
I would contact some operators or individuals that have offerings and get on their mailing list, learn, start consuming their content. And I would do that with a couple different individuals because you're going to get different viewpoints from other individuals. But with the internet of the world today, everything's accessible.
Yeah.
But I think you really want to do, go ahead and start following, if you will, the individuals you think that, you know what, Justin's a stand-up guy. I think I'd like to maybe invest with him. Go to his website, check it out, get on his mailing list and start consuming his content.
Yeah.
To see if it's a good fit for you. And by the way, you're going to be educated along the way because that's what we do. We know people, this is new to most people. They don't know. They think all you can do is keep your money in the stock market. Well,
yeah,
there's a learning curve to this. It's funny. I have people that have known me for 6 years and they just started investing with me. And then I have people that I will meet and in a week, they're writing me a $75,000 check. People have their own journey. So you just got to meet them where their journey is. But I think it's really important, like you said, to put yourself out there, consume as much content as you can. So before you do invest, you're really comfortable looking at the data to say, this is an offering, matches my criteria, and it looks pretty good because you can't, you've got to really do some of your own homework. You just can't carte blanche say, hey, this is a great deal. Go do it. Somebody says that. You need to be able to look at the numbers and say, yeah, they look good to me too.
Yeah, unless you're ultra wealthy and don't really care, then do it.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're like most people that get started in this, you have maybe 250 grand and you're like, okay, I'm going to spread that across a few deals, right?
Yes.
Because typically it's like 50 to 75 grand is minimum. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a small sum of money to most people. So you got to do your due diligence. And I think it's a great time. It's a good and bad time to get into it because to your point, you can Google multifamily syndication or look on LinkedIn or Instagram and see a ton of gurus or experts out there, right? And you have to sift through some of the noise to find the people that are actually good operators, to your point earlier, and not just look at the person that's got the best marketing because they're not always the ones that are the best at operating a deal or whatever. So I think that's important. So I guess to your conversation or point about your passive investors that are talking to you, what are they communicating to you? So if you're talking to them and say, hey, obviously I don't have a deal that I'm working on right now, what's their feedback to you? Are they anxious to write a check? Are they leery? Like what's their sentiment like right now?
Really a mixed bag, Justin. I think there's more people that are thinking about cash preservation because they don't know what's going to happen in the future. So they want to hang on to the cash that they do have. And of course, it's counterintuitive. That's not great. If you have hundreds of thousands sitting in the bank making you no money and inflation is whatever, 5 to 7, 10, whatever percent it is, you're actually losing money sitting there. So I hear a gambit of both. People are 2 years ago, pre-COVID, wow, it was so much easier to raise capital because people were like, yeah, I feel great about the world. I feel great about the economy. I'm going to put it out there. But I've seen in the last year or so, particularly in the last year, people have really restricted and are just sitting on cash. There's still a lot of cash out there being sat on. And I think that's generally what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I would agree. I've got a couple of people that are sitting on more cash than they would like, right? So they have their emergency fund and they have the investing pool and they're like, okay, I want to deploy this, but I want to deploy it in a smart way. And then I've got other people that are like, I'm pumping the brakes for a minute because you do get scared and you're like, cash in the bank is great because I can touch it theoretically and go access it unless it's in Silicon Valley Bank or whatever. But then you have the other side where it's like, I want to put all my money in assets that are going to eventually pay me back, right? Or bring back more friends, more money with me. So I guess your outlook on 2023 would be what?
Cautiously optimistic, I guess.
There you go.
I think it's going to be really slow. And you see articles, it changes on a daily basis.
Yeah.
There at some point, they're going to break and say, you know what? Interest rates can't keep going up. We're going to have to do that. So I don't think anything's going to change dramatically until that occurs because sellers of large multifamily still think they can get these high prices. They still haven't accepted the fact that the world has changed. So maybe they're going to have to sit on it. But as you and I know, and you've alluded to that, some people are going to be forced to sell.
Yeah.
Because They've got some loans that are going to be coming due. They can't refinance those into an acceptable rate. There's going to be capital calls. You're better off selling it, hopefully breaking even, making this money versus doing a capital call. So my prediction is, it's going to be shaky the rest of the year. I don't have a great crystal ball, but I don't think it's going to get any easier the rest of this year. Hopefully next year, I think things will be much better.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to be as rampant as it was the last 2 years. Just people just buying deals as much as they could, essentially. You mentioned the word capital call. Explain that a little bit, because obviously people on this podcast may not know what that is.
So for example, and this actually happened to me in one of my first investments years ago. So I invested $100,000. And then the asset manager that I had invested with walked away from the deal, and one of the partners picked up, and that partner wasn't real strong. And they weren't minding the store, if you will, and the property management company was not doing a great job. Occupancy started to drop. Renovation wasn't happening on schedule. So we ended up losing money over the course of 6 or 7 months. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where they said, you know what, we've dug such a big hole here. They came back to the limited partners and said, hey, in my case, they said, you need to put in another $12,000 to keep us afloat.
Yeah.
And I said, no, what? I'm not giving you any more money. So what they did is they diluted my shares because I didn't put in the extra to maintain mine, which I was fine with that. So that's a capital call. It means somebody messed up.
It's not good.
It's not good.
It sounds like a cool term. It sounds like a great term, but it's not a good
thing. It's a terrible, terrible term.
Yeah.
So the net effect is, this is pretty funny, is that, okay, I walk away from the deal. I got my $100,000 back and I got $60,000 in profit in probably 4 years. So but I should have made $100,000 of profit. So even in that situation, I didn't lose my shirt. I made $60,000 instead of $100,000. Still wasn't real happy. But again, it was my decision. I didn't vet all the partners, and somebody wasn't following up with the property management company and they just ran it down. So yeah, pretty rare, but I guess those are occurring more often.
Yeah, I haven't been involved in a capital call, knock on wood, yet. I know people that in deals that they're in have been. Sounds like you obviously had experiences early in your career doing that. It's, if you get a capital call, that deal is not going well and they need a cash infusion from everybody to keep it going. So it sounds like yours was actually a pretty decent result getting $60,000. A lot of times those end in, you get your money back and that's it. So that's actually a good thing that you made a little bit of money on that one. Sure. So let's finish out here. I've got a triple threat, three questions that I ask every guest. So they're not scary, don't worry. We talked about this a little bit, but as it relates to what you would give advice to another person, but what was one piece of advice that you got that got you started or helped you on your real estate investing journey?
Oh, I think it was really just vetting the individual, because you're investing in a person. The property is really important, but the individual and their skill sets really is going to dictate, because the old phrase is that a good asset manager can make a bad deal okay, but a bad asset manager can make a good deal bad.
Right.
You really need to vet the individuals. And I was taught that early on, though I made one mistake in all my investments. Yeah.
No, that's good. Yeah. And that's exactly right. And we're seeing it now, obviously, with what's going on in the world. So awesome. What is your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Oh, God.
I see your bookshelf back.
Look at my bookcase. My favorite one, business, probably Jim Collins' Good to Great is a really good book. And I guess it's kind of a whole life thing too about, you know, so I read a lot of the mental books, the self-helps, if you will, keep the brain healthy.
But yeah. Mindset is a big thing in life over the last 3 years. A lot of people, if you didn't have a great mindset or didn't have good people to lean on, you could be definitely hurting right now. So that's definitely a good book to read, and also just good genre of books, I guess, to keep top of mind. So this one would be interesting for you because you're already retired, but I'll still ask it. So if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your real estate investing, what would you do?
Not quite there yet. I'm getting close. Though I live in Michigan, so we have crappy weather in the winters. I would go, we live in California. I've lived in California a bit, or Mexico or whatever. I would make sure I'm not exposed to the cold weather anymore. I'll do little trips here and there. We'll be gone for a few weeks at a time, but I will permanently leave for the winter. I think that's where we want to do.
Yeah. My wife and I talk about being dual city people. So you have houses in two places. So you move every 6 months or something to kind of avoid different weather scenarios. So that makes a lot of sense. Matt, it's been awesome to have you on the pod. I'm really excited to chat with you and wrap things up here. But I guess, how do people hear about you? How do people get in touch with you? We'll put some of the stuff in the show notes, but maybe what's the best way to get at you and maybe be on your investor list?
Yeah, just go to hansenholdings.com. I know Justin will have in the show notes. Yep. And I do have a podcast as well. Better Returns, Invest Like a Pro. Check that out as well. Listen to Justin's first. And then you can listen to mine.
I appreciate the plug for yours and mine. I appreciate that. So no, Matt, it's great to have you on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I hope everybody took something away from this episode. I've got another one dropping soon, so keep listening. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.